You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a new report on plumbing poverty and what study authors found, particularly in the Milwaukee metro area. But first, in the third year that schools are trying to figure out how to keep kids safe from COVID in the classroom, some schools have decided just to leave the classroom behind. WPR's Madeline Fox went into the Kickapoo Valley Forest in Lafarge to a school that's outside all year round.
Students and staff start their morning with a song. The key to holding class outside all year in a state where it regularly drops well below freezing is clothing, specifically layers, as demonstrated by 5-year-old Mia Scher.
I have this coat under this coat, and that's...
Mia is one of 29 students in kindergarten at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, a public charter school in the Lafarge School District. She and her classmates are outside pretty much all day, every day.
When some of the children arrived here on day one, I don't think they really, of course, knew what they were getting into. And there were children saying, like, when are we going inside?
That's Janelle Kisa, education director at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve.
And we were able to say, well, we're not. We're going to play outside all day. And now they don't even ask anymore. They just love to be outside.
For the last few years, the Kickapoo Valley Forest School only did a half-day educational program on Fridays. This is its first year of being on a regular school's 5-day regular-length school day schedule. The 5-day school was in the works before COVID-19 hit, but Kisa says the pandemic gave it a little push.
We really had people saying, like, gosh, we want our kids to gather, we want them to have social experiences, but we want them to do it outside where it's safe.
In some ways, outdoor school is a lot like indoor school.
The teachers will often bring learning materials, whether it's math or reading, out into the forest, set up a blanket or a rug, and sit with small groups of children to do instruction.
Jason Rood went into teaching as a second career after he saw few male teachers when his own kids started school. He convinced his teaching program to let him do his hands-on experience at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, where he's one of the teachers who work with kids on their letters and numbers.
Ooh, this one I think is in your name.
I'm listening to you guys.
E. And how does the E sound in your name?
E.
Eh.
School outdoors also has some key differences from more traditional schools. Most days, the kids walk close to 2 miles, hiking through the forest preserve. One week, they gathered walnut hulls and then spent a morning cooking those walnuts down over their fire pit into dye. They brought white T-shirts, and teacher Jimena Puig helped them use an evergreen branch to sprinkle the dye into patterns on their shirt.
If it gets on your snow pants, honey, it will dye your snow pants too. So.
Puig is one of the teachers who helped shape the Forest School's curriculum last year while they were planning for full-time students. She says the outdoor time is good for the kids to get their energy out and learn through interactive play, but it's also good for the future for everyone.
The love that they start to develop for their environment, which is critical for our survival as human beings, that our children come to love and appreciate and care for the environment around them. That is happening because we're out in it.
The Kickapoo Valley Forest School's default is to be outside all day, except nap time, rain, snow, or sun, unless it's so cold that prolonged outside time would be too dangerous. But traditionally, indoor schools have also had some success adding outdoor time, like the Lacouture Ojibwe School in Hayward. Mary Robinson teaches Ojibwe language to grades 9 through 12, which she says works well outside because it's first and foremost a spoken language that can be spoken anywhere.
Especially for Native students, it's really important for all of us to be connected still to the earth and the environment and the outdoors, and we've lost a lot of that by coming inside.
She started taking her students outside last spring after the school brought students back in person and continued this fall.
We still will go outside occasionally when it's chilly out. We haven't been doing it as much lately because high school students don't like to wear coats and boots very much.
Even if she can't bring her teenagers out as much as she'd like, Robinson is part of a trend of schools and families that got their kids outside because of COVID-19, but see it lasting past the pandemic. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to plumbing poverty and a 33-page report that asks this central question: what would you do without running water in your home? And most of us, the researchers say, have never needed to consider this question. The Milwaukee metro area ranked third for the highest percentage of households in this situation out of the 50 largest metro areas in the country studied. And it's a ranking that has not improved as this century wears on. Do you lack consistent plumbing? Do you rent and your landlord has failed to address a lack of plumbing? 800-642-1234. Katie Meehan is principal investigator of the Plumbing Poverty Project. She is a professor in environment and society at King's College London. Katie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us a better understanding as to what defines plumbing poverty.
Yeah, so as research, the Plumbing Poverty Project investigates what we call household water insecurity and infrastructure access in the places we least expect, namely high-income countries like the United States or cities like Milwaukee. And in 2017, an estimated 1.1 million United States lacked complete plumbing in their homes. As geographers, we're interested in finding out who experiences this, where, why, and what produces these conditions of inequality. And this gets me to my second point regarding plumbing poverty. In our research, we use the census definition of complete plumbing to pinpoint that who and where. This is the U.S. Census provides the best data available nationwide on water access in the U.S. They've been collecting this from households since 1940. And the census defines incomplete plumbing as a lack of hot and cold running water or an indoor bathtub or shower. Prior to 2016, this definition also included the lack of a flush toilet. And unfortunately, the census dropped the flush toilet aspect of that in 2016. So plumbing poverty is both a research project. We're interested in kind of wider conditions of household water insecurity. And in the report, we really stick to the census's definition of complete plumbing.
So why would the census decide to drop the flushing toilet question? I mean, wouldn't they want to still know about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. In 2015, for example, there were an estimated 106,000 people in the U.S. who lacked a flush toilet in their home. Recently on the nationwide news, there were some reports in rural Alabama of households that relied on latrines. They didn't have actual flush toilet and connection to sewerage in their homes. The reason that it was dropped was complicated. The census reviews questions on a, you know, semi-regular basis to see if they're still worthy of being included in their kind of long-form household questionnaire. And I believe that they sacrificed the flush toilet question in order to ask questions about commuting time, internet broadband access, which are also obviously important information that governments need to know about its citizenry. However, we would argue that, you know, running water, as well as a flush toilet, are equally important to understand who has it, where, and how do we improve those conditions for American people.
Katie, let's address the who a bit more here. Who is most affected by plumbing poverty?
Yeah, so nationwide, our research found that unplumbed households are more likely to be headed by people of color, to earn lower incomes, live in specifically mobile homes, rent their residence, and pay a higher share of their income towards housing costs. So these people are actually paying more for substandard housing. Interestingly, we found that plumbing poverty is a problem in cities. And most of your listeners might imagine that water insecurity is only a problem in developing countries or in remote rural areas. And that simply isn't true. In fact, our research shows that 73% of unplumbed Americans live in cities and 47% in the 50 largest metro areas. To give you a sense, in New York, they have 65,000 people without complete plumbing. And San Francisco has 27,000 people, a number that increased from 2000 to 2017. While overall plumbing poverty in terms of nationwide is improving, meaning less households are experiencing this than they did in 2000. In some cities, plumbing poverty is getting worse, not better.
And
this includes Sorry, this includes San Francisco and even my hometown of Portland, Oregon.
And that's really what blew me away. Like, Portland and San Francisco are these progressive cities, so much wealth driven by the tech industry. And I have, in my mind, these best practices when it comes to climate and conservation ethics, being at the forefront of so many social issues. But this is an image, in behind that image, not all of this is completely true.
Yeah, I think that, you know, these are certainly, like, I can speak for Portland, for example, these are places with, you know, some progressive environmental and urban planning techniques. But to kind of reconcile equity, which they often call the third leg of the triple bottom line of sustainability, requires a lot of social investment and really progressive mindsets that I think even outstrip a city like Portland. Portland is a fast-growing metro. It's experiencing a tech boom, but it's also experiencing widening income inequality. This is also true for San Francisco. And we're seeing in some of these West Coast cities like Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, that those were actually kind of the worst offenders, so to speak, as cities kind of increase in what we call Gini coefficient, or a measure of income inequality. We can see that some people are getting off pretty well, but there are a certain level of Americans that are being left behind more and more. And these tend to be disproportionately renters, communities of color, and people who are living sort of on the knife edge of housing precarity.
King's College London Professor of Environment and Society, Katie Meehan, principal investigator of this report called Plumbing Poverty in U.S. Cities. Have you had an extended time without running water? What was that like? How do you solve this issue that flies under the radar? Unequal water residents. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing plumbing poverty and a new report that urges Milwaukee to proactively take on water and toilet access issues. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So when the report came out last month from King's College London, there was reaction from around Milwaukee. And an activist group called Freshwater for Life Action Coalition has worked on the lead pipes issue. The group's spokesperson, Robert Miranda, told WPR.
In our work in regards to the lead issue, and we've never run across a house in the urban community and outside of the central city that did not have plumbing.
Join in on your thoughts with this study, 800-642-1234. Katie Meehan, professor in environment and society at King's College London and principal investigator on the report, with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Katie, you know, we also heard from the spokesperson for the Milwaukee's mayor, who said that this defies logic and that there couldn't be thousands of unplumbed homes in the city. What is your response?
Yeah, disbelief tends to be the most common reaction to our research. And I think that has a lot to do around the mythology of kind of progress and equality in America. But I assure you that these are real data about real households, offering a little window into people's lives and struggles. Our source of data is from the U.S. Census Bureau and public agencies, including the city and county and state of Wisconsin, routinely use census data to inform their decisions. So the data are good. I want to point back too that the definition of incomplete plumbing is hot and cold running water or a lack of an indoor shower or bathtub. And so those, you know, keeping that in mind, it's very easy to see that, you know, the 3,000 households, roughly speaking, in the Milwaukee area that lack that, it's entirely feasible within the kind of contemporary imagination. And I want to push back a little bit on the mayor's office. Most likely our estimations are an undercount. And this is because the kinds of households that experience plumbing poverty are what the census calls hard to count populations, including people of color, immigrants, people experiencing homelessness, they are also in a household, or renters who move frequently. And for example, renters were undercounted in the 2010 census by negative 1.1% and Black households by negative 2%. 2%. So these, you know, we expect actually that the number of people experiencing plumbing poverty to be higher than our report conservatively estimates. And I think really it's not so much a shaming tactic, but a sort of wake-up call to decision makers, not just in Milwaukee, but around the country, to see that this is something that is likely predates their mayoral administration. This is a problem that's kind of been occurring at least since 2000 when we looked at some of these data. And in some places it's improving, but in some places getting worse. But overall, you know, in 2021, I think it's reasonable to expect that providing universal running water and sewerage are a basic human right for people living in the United States.
Okay, make the connection here then to racial discrimination and the term redlining that has come to mean racial discrimination of any kind of housing. How are these historic race-based exclusionary tactics in real estate that are part of Milwaukee's history, part of its fabric, how does that connect to plumbing poverty?
So redlining was a common practice in U.S. cities throughout the 20th century, and its legacy we still experience today. Milwaukee is one of the most racially segregated cities in the country, shaped by these redlining practices, which are now illegal but kind of hold the legacy with us. And as geographers, we understand that drawing lines on the map is also done with infrastructure, the kind of access, provision, connections. And so our kind of effort in the report was really to look at two different metro areas that were stagnating in terms of improving plumbing poverty, Milwaukee and Phoenix, both in really different contexts. Phoenix, a fast-growing American city in the Sun Belt region, Milwaukee, a more stable population in the quote-unquote Rust Belt. And we wanted to find out why the kind of numbers of households without complete plumbing had stagnated in both places. And our report begins to kind of paint the urban context of what's going on in terms of social and spatial inequality in Milwaukee. You know, race obviously is a massive predictor of the likelihood that households lack key infrastructure and public services. And so we can see that, you know, infrastructural redlining is a way to kind of signal that it's not just done through mortgage lending practices, that kind of institutionalized discrimination can also come through the legacies of the public infrastructure we provide and the quality of that infrastructure as well.
Katie Meehan with us of King's College London as we look at plumbing poverty, what it means for Milwaukee and other major metro areas. With your questions, 800-642-1234. What will change about plumbing poverty in these pandemic years? Do you imagine your data will worsen or improve or stagnate?
I think, you know, in some parts of the U.S., in the Portlands and the San Franciscos, I expect to see the gap between rich and poor increasing, and with that, the numbers of households living in plumbing poverty also to increase. I do think that it's you know, we in the United States have passed a landmark infrastructure bill. Within that is $55 billion earmarked to replace lead pipes and improve water services. And, you know, we kind of recommend that the federal government look toward using some of this money to connect citizens to networks, particularly for low-income households that wouldn't otherwise have the funds or legal authority available to connect a household or improve the kind of water service provision. So I think actually, despite my pessimistic outlook on equality in America, I also think we're at a critical time in terms of infrastructure, the bipartisan support for that.
$1.2 trillion in federal infrastructure funding exactly. Coming down the pike that could really help solve this kind of problem.
Exactly.
You know, so apologies here if this is far-reaching, but you have also studied water and plumbing in Mexico City, which is a metro area that is, I don't know, 22 million people, giant. How do U.S. cities compare to what you see in Mexico City as how our water is piped and what households experience in Mexico City with waterworks?
I think the dysfunctionality of networked water provision through the kind of piped networks in Mexico City and other cities in Mexico that I've done research, such as Tijuana, is more expected. And there are a lot of informal strategies and ways to kind of work around that. So people have a lot of different modalities of getting water. I actually think water insecurity is almost worse for individuals in the US because there's such an expectation and exclusive reliance on the grid, on piped water networks to supply your water. And if you don't have that, you're going to have to rely on relatives, friends, neighbors, or expensive bottled water. You may need to share public toilet facilities, of which are not commonly available and which are closing in American cities. You're almost more in a tough situation than you are in a more quote unquote developing country like Mexico that has a broader array of water sources and techniques and tactics to make up for the fact that universal water provision is not as high as it is in the U.S.
Wow, that's very sobering. Katie, thank you for joining us and explaining the report.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Katie Meehan, professor in environment and society at King's College London. We have a link to the Plumbing Poverty Report. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.